in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the foreign policy of the Bush administration. And our guest for the show is Ivo Dalder. He's a scholar at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and among other things, is interested in U.S. foreign policy, also European security and arms control. He is the co-author, along with James Lindsay, who is also a scholar at Brookings, of a newly published book titled America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy, and it's published by Brookings. In this book, Ivo Dalder and his co-author James Lindsay look at how it is that the foreign policy of the Bush administration has developed. And in particular, they take on the argument that some people made that the Bush policy has essentially been hijacked by people in and around the administration, particularly those people who have come to be labeled the neoconservatives. The argument that Ivo Dalder and James Lindsay make, however, is that the policy of the Bush administration is very much a product of the president himself and is not so much the result of these other people, although they certainly have had significant input. They also try to make some assessment on long-term what the consequences of the Bush policy will be, and they're not entirely optimistic. So as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but questions from listeners are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point, callers are welcome. Just a couple of other bits of information about our guest, Ivo Dalder. He is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at Brookings. He was, in 1995 and 96, the director of European affairs for the National Security Council. This was under President Clinton, and also he has been an academic. He's been associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at University of Maryland. Mr. Dalder, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you very much for talking with us. I'm fine.
My great pleasure.
We also want to say thanks to the people there at Brookings for helping us set up this high-quality connection. So it almost sounds like you're here in the studio with us.
I'm not in the studio with you.
Maybe I would ask a very basic question. I know how it is that people who object to the policy of the Bush administration would describe it, and I expect we will hear from some people like that this morning. But let me ask you, if I ask this question, what are the hallmarks, the identifying characteristics of the Bush approach to foreign policy? What would they be?
The basic way in which we talk about Bush's foreign policy is twofold. There are hallmarks about which are common and people have commented on along the way. It is a unilateralist foreign policy in the sense that it emphasizes the importance of America going it alone if that is the best way to achieve our objectives. It's a foreign policy that emphasizes the possibility, indeed the need, to preempt threats before they have fully formed or fully emerged. And it is a foreign policy that has emphasized the importance, particularly of regime change, of rogue states. Those are the characteristics one reads in the New York Times or indeed in the Chicago Sun Tribune or any other newspaper and the way it's been talked about. We want to actually take it and do take in our book, America Unbound, it a step further and say what is really going on is that the president has abandoned a 60-year-old consensus about how the United States needs to engage the world, and in that sense that his foreign policy is revolutionary or radical. What do we mean by that? The last 60 years, starting with FDR and Truman, the United States has engaged the world on the basis of a series of alliances with other countries and partnerships on the basis of international institutions that in many ways the United States itself formed and originated, from the United Nations to NATO to the World Trade Organization, and on the basis of international law. What's different in this administration is that these alliances, these institutions and international law are no longer viewed as aids to enable the United States to achieve its interests, but indeed its constraints on the American power. and that an America unbound, an America unconstrained from these institutions and aspects of international engagement is in many ways a more secure America, that the way you maximize America's security in a dangerous world is by minimizing the constraints on Washington's freedom of action. That is a radically different way of looking at American foreign policy than we have had in at least the last 60 years, and one can argue hasn't really been around in the last 100 years.
The thing that one sees, if you go back and you look at some of the things that President Bush said before he became President Bush, when he was running for election, outlining some of his ideas about foreign policy and the involvement of the United States on the world stage, it seemed to be a very isolationist kind of policy. He definitely, in very clear terms, said the United States should not be involved in nation building. And then now, if you look at what the United States has done and the administration has done, particularly after September 11th, and that may be here the key turning point, he seemed to have followed a policy that was diametrically opposed to what he said he believed in before he was elected. So that, and perhaps then that also gets people at this question of, well, who is it that's making the policy now? Can you indeed look at what President Bush has done and said, particularly after September 11th, and connect that back to the kinds of things that he said before that, perhaps even going back to the point where he was campaigning for president?
In fact, the major argument in our book is that the seeds of what we have found in Bush's foreign policy post 9/11 were all there prior to 9/11. And I guess it is because we read the way in which he campaigned and he served his first 8 months in office prior to 9/11 slightly differently than you typified it. And I would say that the way you have typified it is the way that most people look at it. George Bush, even during the campaign, was no isolationist. What he was a person who believed that you had to focus on the great powers, Russia, China, the rebuilding of alliances, as he put it back in his big foreign policy speech in November 1999, and focus on things that are truly important. What he would do differently from what Clinton had done is he would set priorities. He would focus on the things that were in the national interest of the United States. He would not waste American resources or time and energy with projects that Michael Mandelbaum and a scholar at the Council on Foreign Relations had referred to as social work, the rebuilding of nations that really aren't in our interest or where our vital interests are not at stake. So he came to office with a much more narrow, realist view about how the United States ought to engage, focusing on what the truly important issues, those countries that could threaten the United States or that would be necessary for the United States to achieve its objectives. That was not an isolationist view. It was an internationalist view, but a much different internationalist view from that that was there when the Clinton administration was in office. And the issue of nation building really is the issue where both the greatest confusion occurs and also, I think, where the distinction is most apt. It is clear that prior to 9/11 and during the campaign, the president said, as you mentioned, that he did not believe that the U.S. military should be engaged in nation building. It wasn't as much being against nation building per se, though he thought it wasn't necessary in most of the countries in the world because they weren't that wasn't the American interest, whether it was the Balkans or Haiti or Somalia. But it was particularly the U.S. military should not be involved in nation building. He thought it was wrong to involve them in those tasks, that the U.S. military should be geared towards fighting and winning the nation's wars. Now, lo and behold, what happens after 9/11 when we, as a country, are engaged in massive nation rebuilding projects in Afghanistan and Iraq? Well, I think actually what Mr. Bush was talking about prior to 9/11 still upholds. We are not, and our troops are not engaged in nation building in Afghanistan. We have about 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan. Not a single one is part of the International Security and Assistance Mission that is helping to maintain peace and security. all these troops, with an exception of a very few that are part of what are called provisional reconstruction teams, the vast bulk, about 95% of the troops in Afghanistan, are geared towards finding, locating, and killing Al-Qaeda remnants and Taliban remnants inside Afghanistan. And the same is in many ways true in Iraq, where the major focus of U.S. military operations increasingly is counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. As the president said, interestingly enough, just 10 days ago when he was interviewed by Tim Russert on Meet the Press, when he was confronted with exactly the question you mentioned, how can you now say that you're against nation building when you are, which is what you said during the campaign, when you are doing that in Iraq? And his answer was very interesting. He said, "Well, but remember, Tim, what I said during the campaign. I said that I think our military forces ought to be trained to and geared towards fighting and winning the nation's wars. And what we are doing in Iraq is we're fighting a war so a nation can be built." So his conception remains one that says our military forces are not nation-building forces. They are there to confront the terrorists, the counterinsurgents, to create the conditions so that others can build a nation. And frankly, I think that's what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we're not engaged in sufficient nation-building, where people like me who do believe that nation-building is an important aspect of American foreign policy are distraught that we're not doing enough. And in that sense, we're distraught prior to 9/11 because we believe this president was not interested in it, and we're confirmed by it after 9/11.
So, anyone who might hear your recapping of the president's comments in this interview and say that it is maybe it's not on your part, but on his part, splitting hairs in the extreme to draw this distinction between nation building and security. One may indeed feel that way, but what you're saying is that he genuinely and sincerely feels that there is a difference there, and it is a military mission, it is a security mission. The issue is terrorism, and not nation building.
Yeah, I would argue that it's not only that he believes it. I actually think there's a fundamental difference. Mm-hmm. If we were to be serious about nation building in, let's say, Afghanistan, we would have to deploy many hundreds of thousands of troops to maintain and ensure security in the country. This is a country where the government of Afghanistan, its writ does not extend much beyond Kabul, the capital. Much of the country is ruled by warlords. If we are interested in creating a viable state in Afghanistan, I'm not even talking about democracy, but a viable state in which a central government is in fact in control of the territory of the country, in which the monopoly of violence is in the hands of a central authority, we have a long way to go in Afghanistan. We would have to confront the warlords that still continue to rule much, if not virtually all, of Afghanistan. In order to do that, we would have to engage in true nation building. That's not what we're doing in Afghanistan, and frankly, it's not really what we're doing in Iraq, where after having been inside the cities and providing for basic law and order, not very well, I might add, in the cities, we are now pulling out. Our troops are no longer patrolling in the way that they used to in the early part of the occupation, and we're handing it over to the Iraqis. If there is nation building going on, it is nation building that is on the security side. It is nation building that is increasingly in the hands not of the United States, but of Iraqi forces. If we were truly serious about nation building, we in fact would have deployed many more troops than we did. We would have tried to get other countries involved in the security operations. We would have not trained police, Iraqi police, for a week and then sent them out and to be bombed by suicide bombers, but seriously given them a real training course that would actually have some chances of success. Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying is I think when the president says he's against nation building, his actions demonstrate that is in fact the case.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Evil Dalder. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and among other things is interested in European security, foreign policy, arms control. He's the co-author, along with James Lindsay, of a recent book published by Brookings titled America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. Both of them appear regularly on television, radio, and also have written for the opinion pages of many American and European papers. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. As you explained, the administration before September 11th was, in their foreign policy, was focused on major, a kind of major state frame of mind. They were concerned particularly with Russia and with China and the potential threat that they posed, particularly China. After September 11th, we were confronted with a very different kind of threat. How did that change, or did that change, the way that the president and the people who were advising him thought about how the United States should conduct itself on the world stage?
It did change in one fundamental respect, and it did not change in another fundamental respect. The way it did change is that the focus on the big powers that was there prior to 9/11, the belief that if there was a threat to the United States, it would most likely come from a rising China or a rebuilding of Russia and its nuclear and other potential, plus to the extent that some rogue states would be able to acquire the long-range missiles necessary to hit the United States. That really was the focus of American foreign policy prior to 9/11, and that changed. The focus changed. It went from a focus on Russia and the potential threat that China had to a focus on terrorism and on rogue states as such. And Russia and China, in fact, were now enlisted in a grand coalition to oppose the terrorists that had struck us and were striking in Chechnya and in parts of China, them. So that change, that was a fundamental shift away from a concern about China and Russia to an embrace of those countries in a new coalition against terror. Now, the area in which it didn't change, and I think explains a lot about what is happening with American foreign policy and, frankly, what's wrong with American foreign policy, is the notion that the threat that was coming to the United States was a state-based threat, a threat that came from states. The United States, under George Bush, did not shift from a notion that we were moving from threats that states could attack us to terrorists that were no longer beholden by states, but the notion that terrorists themselves were beholden by rogue states in particular. Hence the extraordinary attempt continually up to today to link Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda. There is a belief by the president and the people who serve him that without direct state support, the terrorist really, really could not be a major threat to the United States, that you needed states in order to that harbored them, that provided them with money and knowledge and material and indeed with weapons of mass destruction in order for the terrorists to pose a threat to us. Frankly, I think that is a complete misreading of the threat that confronts us. The al-Qaeda phenomenon is a phenomenon that is not state-based, that to the extent it is able to thrive, it thrives because the state is absent, as was the case in Afghanistan. But it is a transnational phenomenon. It is the ultimate non-governmental organization that doesn't respect borders, it doesn't respect states and the authority of states, and it doesn't really rely on states in order to attack the United States. There was no state involved in 9/11. It wasn't as if the government of Saudi Arabia or the government of Iraq or the government of Iran had decided that the United States needed to be attacked in this way and helped al-Qaeda to launch, plan for and launch the attack. This was done without the support of states. And that therefore the focus that you have in this administration on rogue states, on tyrants, as if that is the same as fighting terrorism. Remember the president continuously saying that Iraq is the central front of terrorism, of terror, which a claim he again made yesterday in Fort Polk in front of the troops. That claim is based on a misreading. The terrorists are not being supported by states. They thrive by the absence of states. And it's one of the great mysteries and mistakes that this administration has made since 9/11.
We have some other callers here, or we have some callers to bring into the conversation. So we'll do that, starting with line number one in Champaign. Hello. Is there a caller there, line one?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Okay, I'm on cell phone.
Oh, okay.
I have two things. One is, it's infuriating for me. All Osama bin Laden is still wandering around doing whatever it is that he was doing originally. He is the perpetrator of 9/11, and our entire focus has been on Saddam Hussein. And for me, it's just, it's a distraction. It was a whole lot easier to get Saddam Hussein than it is, or has been, to get Osama bin Laden. And I think that's why he went into Iraq. I mean, I really believe that. Second point is, I don't believe that the administration has articulated the difference between a policy of preemptive war and how that differs from a simple act of aggression by a state, an unprovoked act of aggression. I don't believe that that distinction has been fully articulated, and I think it's going to be a very difficult distinction to articulate. But other than the claimed intent, we're not going in there in order to take you over. We're going in there because you're going to come after us. Other than the claimed intent, I can see no difference between preemptive war and a simple act of aggression. And so I wondered if you could comment on either of those things. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Both excellent points. On the first one, I do think that Iraq was a distraction. I don't know whether that was why we went into Iraq, but I do think that the effect of going into Iraq was a distraction from the real threat and the really important thing that was going on, which was the need to continue to fight al-Qaeda and to get at the leadership, including Osama bin Laden. I should note that the last big victory we had against al-Qaeda was on March 5th, when we got 2003, when we got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, a senior al-Qaeda leader who was responsible for planning 9/11 in Pakistan. And we haven't gotten anyone since. And one of the reasons is because we took the assets that we had used to track down the al-Qaeda leadership, the CIA agents and other assets that we had, and we redeployed them into Iraq in order to deal with the insurgency and to find the so-called weapons of mass destruction that were supposed to be there. And in that sense, it was a distraction because we don't have those assets now deployed against a threat that I think is more imminent, more immediate, and more serious. So that was a major mistake. Secondly, on the distinction between preemption and lawful aggression, and aggression, there too, I think the caller is making a very important observation. Real preemption has a standing under international law, which basically says if there is an imminent threat, then you, in order to defend yourself, can deal with that threat in anticipation of a coming attack. But it was very clear that imminent threat meant the mobilization of an army or the movement of actual troops, the imminence of offensive action against oneself. The example that people have used is 1967, when Israel preempted an attack that was to occur within days, if not hours, from Egypt and Syria. And everybody widely recognized that to be a legitimate form of self-defense. That's not what we engaged in this particular case. We engaged not in preemption, which was dealing with an imminent threat, but it was an act of prevention. We were moving in before, as the president again said on Meet the Press a couple of days ago, though not, I hasten to say, before the war, when he said we need to move before the threat is imminent. Well, that's preventive action, and it is extraordinarily difficult to distinguish a legitimate form of prevention from an illegitimate form of aggression, and it really does come down to intent. And one of the problems that I think the United States faces in the fact that the very threat that we were seeking to prevent from occurring turns out not to have been there, the weapons of mass destruction, makes it extraordinarily difficult for us to make the case in the future that what we are engaged in is not aggression, but indeed a legitimate form of prevention or preemptive attack. And that is one of the consequences of having gone to war at the time and in the manner that we did.
Let's go to another caller. This is also someone listening in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Thank you. Well, there's much in your analysis that I think is very good. I think where it falls down is in assuming, if you do, that you know, terrorism is really a focus of the administration rather than a sideshow and a convenient excuse to do a lot of things that the Bush administration had wanted and intended to do anyway, whether it be invading Iraq, which they were, you know, planning before they even got into power, let alone, you know, after 9/11, to, you know, curtailing civil liberties at home with the Homeland Security Act, and even to reorganizing the government in ways that it would allow them to reduce the job protections for federal workers. You know, this is being used as an excuse to do a whole lot of things that really have very little to do with actually trying to curtail terrorism. And in fact, if they were really serious about that, they would be putting a lot more money into some things that they're neglecting quite a bit. And I'd like to hear your response to that.
You know, it's very difficult always to judge motives. And one of the things I do at the Brookings Institution is I analyze action more than motive. I don't disagree that that the things that you've mentioned occurred, that in fact the Patriot Act has needlessly in many ways curtailed our civil liberties, that Iraq clearly was a target of many in the administration prior to 9/11, and what 9/11 became a galvanizing force to allow it to do what in many instances it wanted to do beforehand. But counterfactual history is difficult. Would any of this have really happened without 9/11? Would it really have been possible for the United States or for President Bush to marshal the political will within the country, the agreement from Congress, the reasonable support that it still, even up to this point, has had from the American public to, for example, go again to war against Iraq, or to pass such a thing as the Patriot Act, or indeed to reorganize the U.S. government by creating this mammoth Department of Homeland Security. And in many ways, it is my view is that none of that is likely to have happened without 9/11. But what the caller does, I think, rightly puts his finger on, is that the way the administration responded to 9/11 was predicated on its view of the world and on the needs that it had prior to 9/11. That what happened was not that the United States changed, and that the Bush administration changed its foreign policy or changed its view of the world, or indeed the need, its view of the relationship between executive and legislative power because of 9/11, which is generally how people look at this administration, as if there was one kind of administration and policy prior to 9/11 and a quite different and fundamentally changed policy after 9/11. No, in fact, the way it looked at the world prior to 9/11 determined how it would respond after 9/11. I'll give you a classic example, one we mentioned a while earlier. If Bill Clinton had been president, he would have seen 9/11 as a quintessential manifestation not of a rogue state threat, or of Saddam Hussein, but of globalization, the concept that he talked about incessantly, and perhaps too much so, in the last part of, certainly in the second term of his presidency. And he would have looked at this as a reconfirmation for the need to enhance international cooperation, that the way you deal with this kind of threat is to work together with other states. And he might, in fact, not have responded as strongly militarily as President Bush has did after 9/11. So the image and the basic framework and worldview that people take into office is how one determines the response to new facts. It's well known that when we have facts that ought to change our theories, we never change our theories. We mold the facts to fit our theories rather than the other way around. And this administration, frankly, is no different than any other.
We have about 25 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and we'll go on to other callers in just a moment. I would like to introduce again our guest, Ivo Dalder. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He is the co-author, along with James Lindsay, who is also there at Brookings, of a book titled America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. Both of them, Ivo Dalder and James Lindsay, frequently are interviewed on radio and television. They contribute opinion pieces to newspapers here in this country and abroad. Indeed, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he served for some time during the Clinton administration on the National Security Council. He was director for European affairs for the National Security Council, 1995 and 96. Questions are welcome.
David, if I may, just
yes.
One small correction.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Jim, my good friend and colleague, is unfortunately, while still my friend, no longer my colleague. He has moved on and has become the vice president of studies at the and director of studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Just so that if you want to try to find him, that's where he is.
I see. And in fact, I should be able to read that right off the dust jacket of the book.
But he did write it while he was at Brookings.
At Brookings.
I can guarantee that.
Okay. Questions, welcome. We have some other folks here. We'll just keep on. We'll take as many as we can. Again, people can help us by being brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as we have time. Bloomington, Indiana, next. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Talking about preventive action, are you impressed by the fact that even though we face anonymous Muslim fanatical terrorists who are willing to give their lives to kill Americans, there has not been any more suicide attacks, not even one suicide attack, or even a terrorist bombing in America since September 11th. That seems impressive to me.
Yeah, I am impressed. In fact, I was talking to a journalist about this a little while ago. And it's very difficult to know cause and effect.
Surely the terrorists are still willing to give their lives to kill Americans because they do it regularly in Iraq. And it seems to me that the fact that suicide attacks on Americans occur in Iraq, but they do not occur in America, implies that President Bush has successfully moved the war against terrorists out of America.
Well, that is one interpretation. Let's put it this way. There's no doubt in my mind that because of 9/11, and even partly because of what the government and how it has responded, particularly the local state level, but even at a federal level, and how the American public has responded. We now have 280 million first defenders. You and I are much more aware of the possibility of a terrorist attack than we were prior to 9/11. Has it made it more difficult for terrorists to operate in this country? There's no doubt about it. The real question is whether they have an interest in attacking us here, whether they are looking for something that is even more spectacular than 9/11. We really don't know whether it is one whether in fact we are succeeding in making ourselves safer because of our action, or whether it is because of what is happening to the terrorist movement and Al-Qaeda movement, in the sense that they are preparing a bigger, better bang for the buck later on. So it's very difficult to relate cause to effect. And I should note that I think the president, to his credit, is not claimed. I think it would be a little foolish for him to do so in any case, that it is his actions that has meant that there has been no attack in the last 2.5 years here. I should also note that there have been plenty of attacks. They haven't killed Americans. They happen in many instances, though in Iraq there are more. But they have killed many, many, many other people, and they happen to be softer targets. These targets, when they are attacked, do influence the way these countries relate to the United States. Turkey, for example, which was suffered 2 major bombings late last year, is less inclined to support the United States because it feels itself vulnerable by being supportive of the United States. So I think this is a fight that is going to go on for quite a while, and I do hope that our actions individually and collectively here in our country have made us safer, in fact so safe that we that we are not no longer being attacked. But I won't bet on it, and frankly, I don't sleep any more sound by the fact that today or yesterday there was no attack, because I think the possibility is real that we will have one tomorrow.
Well, I do too, and I think that the reason that it's a legitimate fear that they would attack here in America is because they have resorted to softer targets, as you say, mm-hmm. all around the world, and I just can't understand why they would attack, give their lives on November 11th to kill Americans and then stop, unless somehow the foreign policy of the president, the war against terrorism, has been so effective that they are sufficiently deterred. They simply haven't attacked, although you have to assume that they want to.
Yeah, but they also, I mean, there's no doubt that they could. Suicide bombers in strip malls or in malls and around the country is not something we can actually prevent. So long as suicidal maniacs can enter our country, and frankly, given the openness of our borders, they can. It's not difficult to strap a bomb on your chest, as we know, unfortunately, from our almost daily reports from the Middle East. So it can't be the case that we have actually literally prevented people who have wanted to do this, because we're not going to be able to prevent everything, any particular terrorist attack. It must also be, and while I grant that we probably have prevented something, it must also be because they were not intending to do it at this particular time. But you know what? They may be doing it tomorrow. And then what happens to the theory that we are supposedly savored because of the foreign policy of this administration and the domestic security policy of the administration? I grant you, this is a different climate than September 10, 2001, when it comes to the ability of Al Qaeda type people to operate in our country, and all to the better. But I don't have great confidence that we have licked this threat once and for all.
People now, I'm sure if you follow the news, people have seen or heard some of the stories about the unrest that's going on now in Haiti. The president, Mr. Aristide, is facing an armed revolt. Rebels have taken control of parts of the country, and they are calling for his resignation. Now, at one time, the United States was willing to intervene with troops to restore President Aristide when he was elected the first time. Just recently, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has said that the U.S. has no, quote, no enthusiasm for sending in troops to get involved there. Now, I'm not necessarily arguing either that we should or we shouldn't, and indeed, the situation might be easy for the administration to say, well, we have no interest here that we would put American lives at risk. However, having said all of that, I wonder if you think now our experience in Afghanistan and Iraq would in future prevent the administration or an administration from getting involved in some place where arguably we should.
Well, I mean, I think there is, as the Haiti case shows, there may well be a direct interest. Let's see if the chaos continues. And the last time we had that kind of chaos, we had 40,000 refugees hitting the boats for our shores. And it may be that Mr. Bush doesn't think, or Mr. Powell doesn't think, that's in our interest. But I can guarantee you that the governor of Florida thinks it is in the national interest to prevent that from happening. As we all know, of course, is the brother of the president, and would like to have his job after 2008. The issue here is very complicated, and what I think we saw yesterday in with the Secretary Powell saying we're not intervening is this blanket we don't believe in nation building kind of condemnation that you have seen from this administration all along. Remember, Haiti, the intervention in Haiti was the only intervention that the president or then Governor Bush opposed openly during the campaign. He thought it was a mistaken intervention, and it may be because of the chaos that we have today that the intervention certainly didn't succeed in the way we would hoped. at the time when it was undertaken. But the problem with the world as we confront it is that you can't ignore many of these problems just because you feel like it. Not only because the humanitarian tragedies are in some cases extraordinary, think of a Liberia or a place like that, but also because the interests of the United States in some of these conflicts are in fact directly at stake.
Let's go to another caller. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, the caller previous who had said how impressive it's been that there haven't been any attacks, well, I would counter that with saying just how impressive it would have been if you could have avoided the World Trade Center in the first place. And I'm a little surprised that from what I've read, you're very muted. Your attacks are fairly muted, and for example, you don't mention that the National Security Advisor Sandy Berger and Richard Clark made huge attempts, gritting their teeth the whole time, because the previous Bush administration had done almost nothing to help them set up the new administration. But they grit their teeth, and they felt that the nation's security was more important than their bitterness, and they presented a plan to go after Al Qaeda. They had multiple meetings with both Condoleezza Rice and her people, and you know, if the Bush administration had not been so focused on, for example, missile defense and Rumsfeld with revamping the military, you know, maybe those FBI memos coming up from, where was it, Arizona, I guess, about Muslims trying to pick and choose out of flight training might have had some resonance. We might have avoided the World Trade Center altogether. You might want to comment on that, but I do have a question.
Well, we're really getting short on time. You've got to make it quick.
Okay, the question is, in the New York Times, Inge asked you what his major foreign policy beliefs rested on, and in the New York Times it's quoted that it said that you said that the way to ensure America's security was to shed the constraints imposed by friends, allies, and international institutions. And number two, an America unbound should use its strength to change the status quo in the world. And those are very, controversial stance. Could you talk about that a bit? And I'll hang up.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, just those two controversial stands. That is our interpretation of what the Bush administration wants. It's not what we support. But we believe that the Bush revolution in foreign policy is based on the notion that shedding constraints is what will make America more secure. If you were to read to turn the last chapter of our book, America Unbound, you will see that that's not how we view the world. In fact, we strongly disagree with that. Also, the Clinton administration's efforts to warn the Bush administration about Al Qaeda and Afghanistan, etc., are all well documented in our book. And I agree with you that there were these attempts made. I don't want to leave readers with the impression, though, that even if one had taken the threat more seriously than the Bush administration did, and they didn't take it serious enough, we could have necessarily prevented 9/11. I think it would have been extraordinarily difficult to prevent 9/11. Richard Clark, the senior anti-terrorism, counterterrorism person in the Clinton administration, in fact, continued to serve in the Bush administration through 9/11. And even if he was hurt less, it's not clear that even if one had followed all his advice, it necessarily would have prevented what occurred on September 11th. And hopefully we'll find all of this out when the 9/11 Commission issues its report in July of this year.
All right. Next caller is in Belgium, near Danville, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Earlier you made a statement that we're not involved in nation building. Well, it seems as though the individuals living in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue have always stated that their prime objective in the Middle East is to become democratic. That sounds like nation building to me.
Yeah, they have said that, but what have they done to bring it about?
That's another good question.
I'm interested less in rhetoric than I am in the president gives a great speech, but when it comes to follow-on, whether it's budgetary in any other way, I don't think we're spending a lot of time democratizing the Middle East. In fact, today, as we speak here, the president is meeting with the president of Tunisia, one of the great autocrats of all time in the Middle East, and yet he's getting an audience in the Oval Office. Jacques Chirac, on the other hand, would never be invited because, for some reason, he's persona non grata.
Yeah, you get right to the point I'm talking about. Thank you very much.
All right, let's go again to line three in Urbana. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, going back away to that earlier call, I'd like to point out that while there have been no attacks within the United States since September 11th, it was 8 years before that, before there was even a partially successful attack by this group. So I don't think it's so terribly surprising that in the following 4 years there hasn't been one. And I wonder if it isn't so much that they were unsuccessful than they were so very successful in this attack they did pull off, although it was enormously expensive to them. They lost 19 operatives. But before we invaded Afghanistan, the CIA apparently thought there were between 8,000 and 12,000 Al-Qaeda, and now they seem to be estimating that there are perhaps 70,000 agents, and no longer chiefly in the Near East and Middle East and Afghanistan, but seem to have a presence everywhere from the Philippines to perhaps Morocco. Would you comment on this, please?
Yeah, I agree with everything you have said, probably with one change. I don't think it was terribly expensive for them to launch the attack on 9/11.
Well, monetarily it wasn't, but they did lose 19 quite valuable men. These weren't the kind of people you strap explosives on their back and send into a supermarket.
Actually, probably most of them were those kinds of people. Well, they were the thugs. But the pilots, the Muhammad Attas, they were valuable. But frankly, they got quite a lot of them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I do think you're absolutely right. I do not think you can say that just because there hasn't been another attack, just because the other shoe hasn't dropped, that therefore it's not going to happen, or it's less likely to happen, or indeed it is because we have done things right. If I were Al-Qaeda, I would want to follow up the first attack with one even more spectacular than the last one. That takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of planning, and it takes a lot of time to put all of that together. I commend actually you and your listeners a column by somebody I almost never agree with, Charles Krauthammer, who wrote in the Washington Post, I believe it was either this Friday or the Friday before, exactly on this issue. He says, why isn't anybody asking the question why it is that there hasn't been another attack when everybody was expecting it? And he speculates about a variety of things, from coming up with very little of the answer, but making very clear that politically the administration can't claim that its actions were responsible for that, because the next day there may be an attack and then they're caught, which suggests that even the administration has no great confidence in its own ability to prevent the next attack.
We have a couple of minutes left. I want to thank all the callers. I want to go back. In the beginning, you talked about the fact that the administration and its foreign policy had abandoned what had been a long consensus about how the United States should operate in the world, based on alliances, on reliance on international institutions like the United Nations and international law, and that the administration saw these things not as aids to our security, but as constraints, and that the policy that they have taken, marked by the kind of preemptive action, unilateral action, or involving whoever is actually willing to join up, they feel that has made America more secure. Let me ask you directly, do you think that this policy has made America more secure?
In the end, no, for a very simple reason. Harry Truman knew something that I think this president did not know. Remember that we came out of World War II as powerful, perhaps more powerful in relative terms than we are today. And Harry Truman decided that the best way one could extend American power, could sustain it over the long term, was to build institutions of cooperation that served not only America's interest, but those of our friends and allies overseas, that we were going to maintain America's security through the United Nations and institutions like NATO, that we were going to enhance American prosperity through building free trade arrangements and the Bretton Woods financial system, that we were going to enhance our capacity to deal with the threats in the world by creating new partners through the Marshall Plan. Harry Truman and the presidents who came after him understood that working with others, creating institutions, was the best way to achieve the objectives that we had set for ourselves, which were pretty ambitious. It was creating a world that was safe, secure, peaceful, and democratic. This president seems to believe he can do it all himself, that all the threats that are out there are best dealt with alone and by ourselves, and we see the cost of that. Yeah. In Iraq today, where we went in alone, and we are virtually alone today, we are paying the price. We are paying the price in terms of the troops. Some 80% of the troops are American. We are paying it in terms of lives, of the foreign lives. Now, I'm forgetting about the Iraqi lives for a minute. For the foreign lives, 90% of the people killed are American. And we're doing it in terms of the taxpayers. 95% of all the money that is flowing into Iraq are paid by the American taxpayer rather than other people. Hmm. That is a cost that is just too high for us. It would have been much better if we had found a way for others to be with us, so that the cost to us, and therefore the likelihood of success for all of us, would have been that much greater.
We're going to, pardon me for interrupting you, but we're just at the end of our time. We're going to have to stop. I want to thank you, Mr. Dollar, very much for talking
with
us. Our guest, Ivo Dollar, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. We also want to thank Mary Claire there at Brookings for having set up the connection with us on our own, Henry Frayn at the controls on this side.